instant.
You got a cat call. Robbie, it's going to be too dark for me up here. I can't see a thing. There we go. Thank you. It's just us. Is that what you said? Yeah. All right. This morning, we're going to be taking a little break from our normal practice of going through the Bible book by book, chapter by chapter. That's something we're going to continue doing, but we're taking just a few weeks here because Eastgate has changed. Eastgate's grown quite a bit from the time that it began. And there's a lot of faces as I look around. You know, I do my best to get to know people, but there's still a lot of faces that I'm not totally sure. I know who everybody is, and I'm not exactly sure where everybody comes from. And I realize that since that's true from my side, I know that's true from your side as well. And here we are. We're gathering here every Sunday, and we're desiring to form a community of believers who care for each other and look after each other. And one of the things that happens sometimes is when we experience growth, you know, we can come into an environment like this, we can come to a church like this, and we can have certain expectations that we bring with us, either good or bad. And it's important for us to be able to know each other, to know what to expect from each other, know what to expect out of this as a community. And so what we're going to be doing for the next few weeks is we're going to go over the story. There's some of us, you know, who've been here from the beginning, who've invested our lives in this, and it's a very sacred thing to us, and we want to make sure that we're all on the same page, that we know where we came from, and from that point we can join together, unite our hearts together as a community, and begin to move forward from that place of knowledge. And so one of the things that I want to mention is that in your bulletins, you should have gotten, did everybody get a little survey? There's a little piece of paper in there. It's got a survey. It's got a few questions on it. It's self-explanatory. List a few things that you think are beneficial about this community. List a few things that you think may be drawbacks, maybe problematic. And then there's a spot where you can maybe provide a solution, something that you see as a possible change that could take place. And then on the back of it, if you have any questions about Eastgate at all that you'd like the leadership to be able to address, then write that out on the back of that sheet of paper. And if you will, put those in the offering when you leave today, or before you leave today, or bring it back next week and put it in. We're going to deal with these. We're going to kind of have an open panel discussion here with the leadership of Eastgate. You know, you'd think, well, Rob, you know, you should be doing stuff that's more entertaining along these lines. But listen, guys, it's very important for us as a community. I mean, the teaching is very important. We know that, and we're going to continue to focus on that. But at some point, we have to step back and kind of look at who we are and what we're doing here and make sure that everybody's on the same. I mean, you know, you might hear the story of this and think, what in the world am I doing here? These people are nuts and want to get out of here, and I don't blame you a bit. But what we're going to do this morning is in order to give the story of Eastgate, in order to be able to tell the story of Eastgate, I got to actually back up, because since I end up being the person who does most of the teaching around here, and a lot of times that ends up being a large portion of the philosophy that guides this fellowship, you kind of need to, as I stated last week, you know, when you look around at some of the ways we do things here, it's because I got a lot of baggage. And so it's important for you to know my story. It's important for you to know where I'm coming from. That's going to help to define why it is we maybe do some of the things that we do. And the next time we're going to get together, we're going to talk about how this fellowship as a whole came together and what our philosophy of ministry is. So this morning, I'm going to tell you my story, if that's cool. I mean, you know, I've been nervous about this. I'm so nervous standing here right now. I've been a pastor now for 10 years. I have never, ever yet told my testimony. So it's new experience for all of us. So if you're willing to hear it, oh, please don't do that. Holy cow. Now I'm really nervous. Now you're expecting something good. Okay, listen, to tell you my story, though, I'm actually going to have to rewind a little bit. I got to tell you my dad's story, or at least a part of that, because whether I liked it or not, my story ends up being an extension of my dad's story. Our stories became intertwined. I wouldn't have realized that, and if you'd asked me that when I was a kid, you know, you would have... why don't you go ahead and put that slide up, please? Is that... That's what I'm looking at you for. Oh, you know what? I messed up. I've actually got a roll-in video, and that I can't even believe I didn't even do that before we started. And we were filming this, and this stinks now. Okay, roll that, if you will, please. Man.
Why do you come to Eastgate?
Because I really enjoy the music, and I love the lessons, and it makes me feel a lot closer to God when I get here.
Why do you come to Eastgate?
Because it's fun, and I have friends here, and I like the environment, and the services aren't boring.
I feel comfortable here. I get a lot out of it. I love that I don't feel judged here. I feel at home.
Why do you come to Eastgate?
Eastgate?
Eastgate Christian Fellowship, big sign there. Why do you come to Eastgate?
I thought it was the Amway meeting. I'm sorry.
Why do I come to Eastgate? I would have to say it's something that makes me feel like I'm really, you know, like I'm really just spiritually, I don't know, strong after I leave here. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I come to an Eastgate. And I really can't think.
I come to Eastgate because it's family. And it's real. And it is not traditional. And it doesn't feel religious. It just feels like Jesus, man. A bunch of Jesus freaks and Bible geeks. And that's what I am. I love it.
Do you have to take those out when you go through metal detectors?
Yes.
Hey, Pat, why do you come to Eastgate?
Because Jesus is everywhere. People are fun.
And how did Eastgate get started?
Eastgate was a home study group in first Riley's house and then Rob's, and I was there. it was very good, and it was just sort of a leading from God. The building became empty, and they asked if we wanted it, and Rob had to pray real hard to see if he was supposed to go and deal with a bigger group of people, and it worked.
But that's really what Eastgate is. It's like a giant Bible study in a living room. We always remind people of that. Don't get into this formality. It's just a big Bible study, a bunch of people that love Jesus. And that's another reason why I keep coming back.
How did Eastgate get started?
I don't know.
How did Eastgate get started?
I have no idea.
Eastgate itself, I'm not exactly sure how it got started.
How did Eastgate get started, you know?
By God.
Pastor Rob had troubles, and so he decided to make a non-denominational church, and so that way, like, anybody could come, and it wouldn't be like, you don't believe in the rapture, or do you believe that we should sprinkle on heads, or do you believe we should duck?
How did Eastgate get started?
I don't know.
Did it get started in your living room?
Oh, good grief.
No, it didn't?
No!
Actually, ladies and gentlemen, Eastgate was hatched by an alien egg laid by Rob Woodrum. And after it was hatched, it grew into the seething green monster known as Eastgate. All those people were wrong, I hate to tell you.
That was supposed to be the introduction explaining why it is we need to give the origin story, because as you see, there's a lot of people who don't know how this all got started. So this morning I'm going to give you my story. Now my story, I've got to back up. As I was saying, I have to back up and tell you my dad's story, because my story ends up being an extension of his. I never would have dreamed that. As a kid, if you would have asked me, would my story be an extension of his story, I'd have told you no possible way. But I got to go back 105 years to start my dad's story, when in 1901, my dad was born as Alonzo Woodrum. He changed his name later on to Lon Riley Woodrum because it sounded more poetic or something. But he was not born into a godly family at all, or a God-fearing family. They had a vague association with the Catholic Church, but there was no real value system that had any trace of Christianity involved in it when he was born. He grew up, it was a rough time. It was pre-World War I, and they lived on a farm, and it was very difficult, a very difficult life, and his family began disintegrating. And at the ripe old age of 16, my dad and his younger brother took off from home. They left their home and they went out into the world on their own. Started riding rails with the hobo culture in those days, going back and forth between Kansas City and California. And it was there that my dad basically grew up. That's where he came of age, riding the rails with he and his brother. And by his mid-20s, my dad's life had really taken a turn for the worse. I mean, by his mid-20s, my dad had lived hard already. He was deep into criminal activities. He was into drug abuse and alcohol abuse and had been in and out of jail. And one time in Kansas City, Missouri, he was walking around and he saw this lot and there was a big tent set up on this lot. And he asked a buddy of his, he said, "What's going on there?" He saw people going in. He says, "What's happening in there?" And his buddy said to him, "Well, that's religion." And my dad looked at him and said, "Religion in a tent? What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, let's go in there. Let's find out." And so my dad and this guy walked into this, and it was a tent revival. My dad wasn't familiar with anything associated with evangelical churches at that time. So he went into this tent. He sat down there on the front row, and he listened to this man give the story about Jesus. And that night, as my dad listened to that story, something got through to his heart, and it registered as being a reality with him. And he went down front when an altar call was given, and he prayed before the Lord. And he said, "Listen, I don't understand this. I don't understand much about you. But," he said, "I believe in you, and I'll serve you. I'll follow you from here on in." And he got up from that a changed man. Everything for him turned around at that point. He was completely different. And I'll tell you, because he made that decision, because he made that choice that night, we're all sitting here in this room here this morning. It's an amazing thing. We have no idea the far-reaching ramifications of some of the choices that we make and how God is weaving his plan together. But that certainly is a part of it. My dad felt a calling to preach, and so he started in with the Nazarene Church, and he traveled all over the United States as an evangelist. He preached all over the place. He met a woman named Gertie, and they got married and had two children, Ruth and Paul. And this was all through the 40s. And then as things go, because human relationships are very difficult and very messy at times, my dad and Gertie ended up getting divorced. And that just about ruined his ministry. I mean, it just about took everything away from him. He had to leave the Nazarene Church at that point, and he joined with the United Methodist Church. But things started coming back together, and my dad, you know, was a fairly popular minister within the Methodist Church. I mean, he traveled all over. He traveled to every state in the Union. In fact, Ron Ball, who's the pastor over here at Woodlawn, was familiar with my dad. He'd hear him preach up at the camp meetings up in Alabama. So he was all over the place. And in the 1950s, my dad met a woman named Eileen, who was a school teacher, and they got married. And they had two kids, Riley and Robin. And that's where my story begins. And I had to back up and tell you about my dad because it does get intertwined here. But I was born, unlike my dad, I was born into a Christian family. I was born in a family that taught Christian values and had a Christian worldview. And my dad was 60 when I was born. I just keep thinking about that, feeling so bad for him. I can't even imagine what happened to his psyche at that point. You know, 60 years old, you think you're done with all this, and then you got a baby around. What that meant, though, for me was that basically I didn't know my dad. My dad was really never around as I was growing up. As a matter of fact, when I was a little kid, you know, he'd come around. He was just kind of a strange curiosity to me. I wasn't sure who this man was, but he was kind of interesting. And one day I got my courage up and I went over to him and asked him, you know, who are you and where do you live? And you know, he looked at me and my brother was there and he goes, "You dummy, that's our dad. He lives here." And I was like, "Yeah, no, seriously, where do you live?" And so I didn't put it together. It was a long time. I was like 18 or something. No, I'm just kidding. But it took me a long time to figure out that this guy was my dad. He was just pretty much gone all the time. He was ministering and teaching and all and traveling a lot. So my early childhood, my family consisted of my mom and my brother. And that's what I knew. And in my early childhood, we lived in this rural environment out in a big farmhouse out in the country in Michigan. My dad put together this tiny little... Not my dad, my mom put together this tiny little farm. It was kind of a weird thing. She was raising goats and collies and stuff. My mom was a piece of work. I'll tell you, she was such an interesting character. She was so conservative on so many things. I mean, she voted Republican down the line. She was a very conservative individual. When it came to Christianity, she was conservative. But when you got into issues like social justice or you got into issues of cultural things like, well, let me put it this way. She's the only one I ever knew who was a registered Republican who also had a subscription to Mother Earth News back in the 60s. And she'd get the Whole Earth catalog and we ate organic food and took vitamins and stuff. I won't touch that stuff to this day because of that. If it doesn't have chemicals in it, I don't want it. But so anyway, those were, you know, that's the way we grew up. Those were innocent days. I mean, I look back on those days. That was a wonderful time in our lives. You know, I had a good relationship with my mom. I had a good relationship with Riley. Actually, I can let Riley kind of tell a little bit of that story. He gives a little insight from his perspective on that. You want to run that for me, please?
I remember being, you know, at the house there, growing up in Michigan. I remember vaguely life without him, but I remember more succinctly the, you know, going to the hospital where mom was and the whole thing about we're going to have a new baby in the house. And I guess there's a story my mom told us. I don't remember saying it, but when she was explaining to me we were going to have a new baby in the house, telling me all about it, and I guess my question was, well, where are we going to put him when he cries? From there on, it was just that was a normal part of life, was, you know, my little brother, Robin. And for the most part, we got along pretty well, especially when we were younger, playing with G.I. Joes, swimming at Sugar Bush Lake down the country road from where we live. Mostly, in those early years, was really good memories. You know, sometimes he was a pest. He's little kids, you know. He was 5 years younger than me. So the older I got, sometimes there was a more of a gap. But especially when we were young, I remember Christmases and summer vacations. It was quite a bit of fun growing up.
We had this, you know, we had a good relationship. I mean, it was really an idyllic time in my life. And I look back at those as very innocent days. But again, as life goes, and because there's so much mystery and chaos usually associated with human relationships, my mom and my dad separated. And so that period of my life didn't last very long. And when I was 9 years old, my mom felt it was necessary. And I don't blame her. My dad was not an easy person to get along with. And of course, he was gone a lot. But my mom decided she needed to put some separation between she and my dad. And so she packed Riley and I up and she took us to Guatemala, where she had taken a job teaching missionary kids down there. So Guatemala, that's a whole story in itself. I really don't have time to go into that, but what an adventure that was. We stayed there just long enough for Riley and my mom to get hepatitis B. And then once that was accomplished, we headed back home. And when we got back home, we got back to Michigan, my mom decided that she was going to take a job down in Columbus, Ohio, teaching school. And so she moved us. She took Riley and I, and we moved down to Columbus, Ohio. And that was a huge shift that was a huge turning point in my life. We went from this rural environment, this very rural, kind of idyllic, innocent realm, to a more urban, suburban kind of a culture. And here in this situation, my mom had to work full time, and my brother was older than me. That 5 year gap became a lot older because he's, you know, I'm 10 years old and he's in high school, and so I became a latchkey kid. I don't know if you remember latchkey kids, but I had a little key that I'd hang around my neck on a chain, and everybody was gone when I'd get up in the morning to go to school, so I was making my own breakfast, and I'd get home and I'd make my own dinner, and I found myself kind of just lost in this environment here, because it was so much upheaval. Everything was so different for me, and now suddenly I didn't even have my family around me, so I was left to kind of find a different kind of a family, find some kind of a family that I could put together out of my peers, out of the kids who lived in that apartment complex where we were. And so that's what I did. What I found out early on was that this Christian worldview that I was raised with wasn't going to help me at all in trying to connect with these peers that were there. Now, as a kid, I can look back in those days when I was in Michigan, I can remember back to the very first sense of a God consciousness I ever had. I was a little kid, and we were up there in Michigan, and I was sitting in a bathtub, and I was filled with Mr. Bubble Bubbles, and I really don't know how old I was. I was pretty young, and I remember staring at a bubble and it occurring to me that there is a God, and I'm accountable to him in some way. Now, obviously, I wasn't thinking it that articulately necessarily, but the very essence of that was there. I suddenly realized that there is this God, and my life is somehow intertwined with that. And it was frightening, but interesting and thrilling at the same time. I can remember that to this day. But here I am now in Ohio, and I'm being challenged with this realization that if I'm going to try to carry this Christian worldview or these values around, it's going to alienate me from these friends. It's going to be a real obstacle for me to be able to put together some sense of family or some sense of belonging with these kids. And so I realized then, having no anchor point at home, I realized I was going to have to put some space between me and that Christian worldview. And then I realized that because my dad was a preacher, I had to do more than just put some space there. I had to really outdo the world. I had to outworld the world in these things. So that when the kids in the apartment complex started stealing, well, man, I was going to steal twice as much. And when they picked up different habits like smoking or get into their parents' liquor cabinets, well, man, I was going to do it twice as much. I was going to make sure that they knew that I wasn't part of that whole worldview and there was nothing restraining me, and I was going to be the life of the party and I was going to be accepted because of that. And so that's what happened in my life. And my mom saw that slide taking place. She saw that beginning to develop in my life. And so at that time, she's a single mom. She made the only choice that she could make, and she took me out of public school. She felt like, well, if his peer group is what's influencing him to do the wrong thing, I'm going to put him in a place where he'll have the right peer group. And so she took me out of public school and put me in a private Christian school, which at that time, and in that case, was probably the worst thing she could have done. Christian schools were fairly new in that time period in the 70s. That wasn't a real popular thing. They were smaller things. It was just a growing movement at that time. And most of the kids that, no, I'll say 99% of the kids that were in there were not there because they were Christians, but because they were just like me. They were kids that were starting to fall into the wrong crowd. And so parents said, oh, we'll get them over here into a Christian school. So now you got this really tight concentration of kids like me who are determined not to have anything to do with a Christian worldview. I mean, there was one kid, I think, who might have been a Christian there, but I was making it my personal, you know, goal to make sure I converted him away from it. It was a rough time, because the other thing that happened to me in that environment was Christianity went from being an obstacle to putting together a new kind of peer group or family for myself, a place of belonging, to becoming actually this oppressive force that I saw as being something that was going to try to crush me. Because, well, I mean, it was a private school. When I was in elementary school, in public school, you know, when I was a little kid, they were allowed to spank. You know, the teachers were allowed to paddle you. They had paddles. I mean, I remember, you know, they had holes drilled in them to cut down wind resistance, names on them. I mean, it was an amazing thing. I spent first, second, third, fourth grade. I was always out in the hall. You know, you get sent out in the hall and you're going to get paddled. And that was the worst part of it. So waiting to get paddled. You know, the paddling itself wasn't that bad, especially over time. You learn in the morning, you just stuff your front pockets full of napkins and paper towels and things like that, so that when you get out in the hall, you transfer those to the back pocket to pad it a little bit. You know, when you know you're going to get spanked every day, you get a little more proactive about the whole thing. Change your behavior? No. Pad your butt. But anyway, so by the time I was in fifth grade, you know, they quit doing that. They were saying, oh, no, you know, you can't spank anymore. And I was like, yes. But I get to this private school and they had no such notions like that. I mean, they're not going to, you know, listen to what the world says. And they didn't just have paddles. They had Hot Wheel tracks that they would beat you with. And I'm telling you, have you ever been beaten with a Hot Wheel track? There's nothing like it. They should put those in the prison systems. I'm telling you, that was painful stuff. Those are harsh memories. And so, of course, I followed, you know, my normal pattern, and there I was. I was, you know, usually the recipient of those things. And I was determined. I was going to break with these people. They were going to break me. I was going to be what I wanted to be, blah, blah, blah. And at one point, a friend and I got in trouble for something, and I don't even remember all the details, but the bottom line is, they got me in there, and they had, in the process of doling out their punishment, I broke. I mean, as a 13-year-old kid, I just, you know, I'd never cried in front of them, but I just, at that point, I just didn't want to get hit with that thing anymore. I broke, and I told on my friend. And that changed the whole dynamic of my time there at that Christian school, because before I'd kind of been a ringleader and people kind of looked up to me and we were doing all these things, but now all of a sudden I was ostracized. I was a rat. I mean, I'd told on my friend, I broke, I did all this stuff. And I mean, not only was I ostracized, but I'm every day from that point on, the whole rest of the time that I was there in that school, I was the object of constant mockery and physical abuse and mental abuse, just the whole gamut of things. It was tough. And of course, I couldn't go home and tell my parents about it or my mom about it, because then I'd be, you know, shedding light on the fact that I hadn't been a good kid or anything like that. So I couldn't tell her. And the teachers at this school all saw what was happening, but from their perspective, and you can't blame them, they're kind of like, well, this is what you get. This is what you were aiming for. And, you know, that's true. But it doesn't change the fact that there was just it was such a bitter thing in your mouth to suddenly realize that you had no allies. I had no allies anywhere in the world at that point. And so through a series of events where somehow a bathroom got vandalized, I got kicked out of that school. And so I was taken out of there and put back into public school, and the whole process had to start all over again. I had to try to find some kind of group of people that I could connect with, some kind of sense of belonging that I could have. I was, you know, searching around for my peers to try to cobble together a surrogate family from them so I felt like I belonged somewhere. So once again, the whole pattern had to start. Whatever drugs that they were doing, well, I had to do them too. Whatever parties they were going to, I had to go too. Whatever habits were beginning to develop in their lives, I was going to have them as well. They were all going to be mine. And I realized at that time that the lesson that I learned from that Christian school was that if I'm going to put together a life or a family out of the friends that are around me, then it's very important that I please them all the time. If I'm going to be acceptable to them, then I got to perform well. I got to pull my weight. I got to never let them down. I got to please them. And I'll tell you what, there's no harder life to live on this earth than living that kind of a life where you feel like the only measure of worth you have is based on other people's view of you. So that's, you know, by the time I got to high school, I was working overtime to destroy myself. I mean, and I don't want to, you know, sound like as if my family were bad or anything like that. I mean, you know, obviously my mom's going through the turmoil she was going through with dealing with a separation and trying to earn a living. And man, to her credit, we never went without food or anything like that. You know, and my brother was just pursuing the things that he was pursuing. We tried our best to care about each other, but we just didn't connect. I mean, it was kind of like I was in a little dinghy and drifting farther and farther away from the main ship. And that's just the way it was. It wasn't anybody, you know, so much to blame on that or anything like that. Now, during this period of time, my mom was searching around for something, and she got involved in the charismatic movement. She had a charismatic experience, and she and my brother both, and they kind of started through the 70s, were looking at all the different charismatic ministries that were popping up everywhere, and they were exploring a lot of these things, and during her exploration of this and investigation of this, she came across a church that was up north, and she really liked the teaching that was coming out of that place, and you know, it just seemed intellectually stimulating and more substantive than a lot of the other faith teachers that were out there, and it promised this mystical sense of exclusivity that, you know, they had the corner on what God was really doing, and if you really wanted to get in on what God was doing, you're going to have to join up with them. And so my mom did. She really, you know, got involved in that and got interested in their teachings and began adapting them as her own. And I was only vaguely aware of what was going on, you know, in their lives at that time. I just knew things had changed. All of a sudden my mom was, you know, talking about speaking in tongues, and they were talking about visions, and she bought 20 acres of land down in Florida in Dufuniac Springs. I was always calling it Dem Funky Springs, but she bought this, and they were going to have an end time, you know, shelter during the tribulation or something. And you know, so strange things were happening in my house. I mean, all of a sudden we quit celebrating Christmas, and the closet there in one of our, in our hallway suddenly got filled up with stockpiles of freeze-dried foods and things like that, you know, storing up for the rough times in the tribulation or something. So it was, you know, things had taken a turn for the weird. And, I mean, you know, you think about it, here I am, I'm out in la-la land and party animaldom, and here, you know, my brother, Riley, he's like a college dropout, you know, he's at that time, and, you know, he's studying about alternative power sources like wind source and stuff, because he's going to go down to northern Florida and build an end-time shelter with his mom. And my dad would just show up every once in a while and during these surreal visits where he's just passing through to somewhere else. And I'm just telling you, it was weird. There's a picture. This kind of sums our family up at that period of time. This is, you know, over there on the left, you got Riley. Some sort of bizarro lumberjack out in the middle of suburbia. I'm over there. It doesn't look like I've bathed in weeks, at least for, you know, over there. My mom's clearly not happy to be there. And my dad shows up like some kind of Russian immigrant or something who just wandered into the picture. That just kind of sums up the whole era for me. You talk about, you know, sometimes you can think of this and you think, oh, Rob, you know, he had his pastor as a dad and it was a Christian environment. It's all wonderful. I'm telling you, we had dysfunction in spades, man. It wasn't even funny. So at 16 years old, at 16, my dad had gone out on his own, struck out into the world to find his way. When I was 16 years old, yeah, there you go. When I was 16 years old, it was kind of the same thing. I was out in the world on my own. Now, it was different from my dad because he struck out on his own. For me, my mom packed my bags and came to me and said, "You're striking out on your own now." It wasn't quite like that, but you know, good for her. I wasn't willing to live within the boundaries of the values that she wanted to embrace. And you know, I don't blame her for that. She had to draw the line. She's a single mom trying to figure out what to do. And she determined that she was going to uphold those values and not allow me to dictate what was going on. So good for her. She told me it was time to go. Bad for me. I went to live with a friend and his mom, and then I got my own apartment and with a roommate later on after that. And so I finished out my last year of high school in this apartment, you know, that was just party central at that point. I mean, you know, just use your imagination. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, it was nonstop. It was constantly on the go. And the punk movement was starting around that time, and we'd go down to Ohio State campus on High Street and go down to the underground, and we'd listen to bands like the Screaming Urge, and I was getting into it. You know, the whole punk scene. I joined a band, and we started touring all over the United States. That's so not true. We didn't tour anywhere. We played parties around there, and we never finished an entire set because the cops would always show up. But anyway, we were doing all that. But you know, when everybody graduated and school was out, and I was still kind of in that mode, I'd put together a nice little family unit that I felt was something I belonged to. These peers, these friends that I had, and they accepted me because I was just, you know, the life of the party. I was going and going and going. And then, of course, when we all graduated and they started going off to college and started to think in terms of adult life and responsibilities, and I was still back here doing Mr. Party Animal scene, oh man, it began to disrupt all around me. I mean, my whole life was unraveling before my eyes. And at that period of time in my life, I mean, I was doing a lot of drinking. I was taking a lot of speed. I was not sleeping, and I started missing work. And I'm living in this apartment, and you know, I moved from, I had my own room there, and they had to move me out of there to get another roommate in who would actually pay his bills. And so I got relegated to the guy on the couch status. And I don't know if you've ever had an apartment with a bunch of guys, but that's there's always some guy on the couch, and that was me. And at that point, I was, you know, they were kind of putting up with me because I was sort of fun, but at the same time, there were some other things that were beginning to happen in my life. And you know, you can sit here and you can listen to somebody talk about it, and believe me, when I was a kid, I'd listen to guys tell their stories and they'd talk about doing drugs and all these things, and there was a certain kind of, I don't know, fascination with it. Wow, that's cool, they did all that. But I'm telling you, yeah, there might be some fun associated with that sort of stuff. But make no mistake about it, there is always a price to pay. There is always a price tag associated with any kind of lifestyle like that that abandons what God's purposes are for our life. And for me, the price tag was very steep, because all of a sudden, I got to the place in my life where I was losing my choices on things. What I mean by that is, maybe it was because I was a very unstable post-adolescent. Maybe it had something to do with all the alcohol, speed, and sleep deprivation, but I was starting to lose touch with reality. I was starting to see things that weren't really there. And I'm telling you, there is nothing more horrifying than getting to a place in life where your choices have led you to a place where you don't have a choice anymore. All the things that I'd done, all the parties that I'd gone to, those were my choice. Man, I chose to do those things. I determined to do those things. But they led me to a place where suddenly I had no choice. I lost that choice. And I'm telling you, there's nothing more frightening in the world than suddenly realizing you have no control over certain things. I had no control over what my mind was doing to me at that time. And of course, that began to alienate my friends, and it culminated with one day a friend had come over to the apartment. I had missed work, and a friend had come over there. People were there in and out all the time, but she found me running up and down the stairs. We lived in this townhouse apartment. She found me running up and down the stairs. She said, "Robin, what are you doing?" I said, "Listen, I'm not alone in this apartment. I don't know what's going on here, but there's somebody following me around. And every time I try to turn around and see them, they're just out of sight. They're just gone." And so I said, it dawned on me that if I run to the top of these stairs as fast as I can turn around and maybe catch them in this narrow space. I said, "You want to help?" And she was like edging towards the door. Psycho! So, you know, all my friends were getting alienated by this point. You know, Rob's falling apart. And so they all had a meeting with me. And I am telling you, you know you're in trouble when you're the subject of an intervention staged by all your druggy friends. Rob, we gotta talk, man. It was a mess. So So their solution was to take me out on a two-day bender and then send me to Florida, where my parents were. So honestly, I don't remember much of that that happening, but I do remember kind of coming back to reality and sitting on a plane headed towards Florida. I find out from the stewardess, where am I going? You're going to Florida. Okay, I'm going out to my parents or whatever. And Ronnie can kind of tell you what it was like meeting me at the airport there.
Everybody moved down here, and Rob was still back up in Columbus. And I remember he was going to come down and visit us. I guess it was a visit. I wasn't sure if he was coming for good or just for a visit. But at any rate, he was flying down. And so we all went over. My dad and my mom went over to Fort Walton to the airport there to meet him. And that was kind of an amazing experience because when he was coming off the plane, at first I didn't really quite recognize him. His hair was a lot longer than I'd ever seen it before. I knew he'd had some longer hair before. I'd had longer hair in high school back in the 70s, man. But his hair was long and scraggly, and the other thing that just really was amazing, when I went to give him a hug, is he really smelled pretty bad. It was a definite odor, and I couldn't identify it, but it was not really pleasant. I don't know. He just seemed, he just didn't seem like the brother I had known. That was the thing that struck me. It said, you know, he looked different. He smelled different. He just seemed different. He didn't seem like the Robin, the brother that I knew.
Okay, so I come down to Florida, and I realized at that point I had to try to do something. I had to get my act together. And, you know, that's the stages that you go through. I was thinking, I'm going to reform here. I'm going to quit behaving like this. I had no heart change at this point, but I determined I was going to, you know, I'm going to get things together. I'm going to get my act together. And I was living there with my family and trying to do my best. You know, I'd show interest in some Bible studies and do, you know, what you need to do, but it didn't last. And nothing like that ever lasts. And after a while, that same strange dissatisfaction was just gnawing at me again. So I found myself down in Panama City. I moved, they were up in Dafuniac Springs. I moved down here to Panama City and was working at odd jobs, went to Gulf Coast for a little while. But then a friend of mine, James Wood, was airbrushing t-shirts in the mall. It was the first t-shirts plus that had been there. And so he said to me, "You want to learn how to airbrush t-shirts?" And I said, "Sure, man, that sounds like fun." So I learned how to airbrush at that point. James taught me, and we started making some money, and he and I got an apartment, and we were just, you know, we were just going at it. And all of a sudden, the whole process started all over again, and the whole party scene began to develop. And once again, I found myself working overtime to try to please those people who were around me in order to try to gain some sense of acceptance and belonging. And James and I decided to take a trip out to Reno. We were gonna go to Reno, Nevada, and start airbrushing t-shirts out there and show everybody what it was like. And of course, that was a debacle. That only lasted about 6 months. And we came back here. And when we came back, it was off season. I couldn't get a job as an airbrush artist or anything like that. And all of a sudden, here I am, right back in that exact same situation. I'm being supported by my friends who are getting really kind of tired of that. And I'm drinking way more than I'm supposed to be. And all of these things are beginning to develop again. And I'll tell you, as I saw my friends begin to back away from me, and I saw myself falling into that same pattern once again, just almost like when I was back in that private school, I broke. I mean, I broke, and I just thought, what am I doing? What am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? How am I going to stop this cycle from happening? Is this just my life? Is this just who I'm going to be? Is this just going to happen over and over and over again? And I took a walk. I was living in a trailer out in Callaway, and I took a walk, and I walked all the way down to the Panama City Mall. And I went in there and went to the payphone and tried to think of who I could call. And all I could think of was my family back in Dafuniac Springs. And so I called my mom's house, and I had to make a collect call because I had no money. And I called my mom's house, and Riley, my brother, answered the phone. And I told him, I said, "Riley, I'm back in Florida." They didn't know I was there yet. I said, "I'm back in Florida, and I was just wondering if I could just maybe come out and visit you guys." And I said, "I don't have a car. I don't have any way to get there, so you'd have to come pick me up." And I'm telling you, Riley answered without hesitation, "I'll be right there." And I think about that, and if it hadn't been for him making that choice, if it hadn't been for his selfless act on that, we wouldn't be gathered here like this today, like we are. It's amazing how far-reaching the consequences of kindness can be. So 2 hours later, I found myself in Riley's truck, and we were heading back over to the Funiac, and I sat there with my family that night, and I was thinking back through my whole life and what I'd experienced so far. And I really believe that little boy who sat in the bathtub staring at a bubble came back to the forefront of my consciousness that night. And I realized there is a God, and my life is intertwined with him somehow. And I surrendered. And like my dad, I would have been raised in the values, but I really didn't fully understand what this meant. I just said, God, I don't know exactly what it means or how this is going to work out, but I quit. I quit everything else. I'm going to give my life to you. I'm going to surrender to you. You take over now. And I'm telling you, all those years that I spent running up and down with my arms just outstretched to my peers, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be long somewhere, wanting to be loved. That night, I turned around and to my surprise, found these outstretched arms of my Savior who'd been there all along. And I fell into his arms and I fell into the arms of my hero. I fell into the arms of my Savior. I fell into the arms of my Father. And I knew I was home. Nothing was the same from that point on. And oh, what a wonderful experience that was in my life. I mean, I didn't leave that property. You know, they were out in the woods and stuff. You know, that's where you build end time shelters, in the woods, because the Antichrist is afraid of the woods. Everybody knows that. But anyway, for 6 months, I barely ever left that place. I mean, I was just getting into the Word, and I went through the New Testament just book by book, chapter by chapter. And I was writing down, I filled up, you know, spiral bound notebooks all over the place with things that I was observing in that and things that I was fascinated with that. And then I started comparing it to other scholars' works to get an idea of, you know, what I really needed to learn from this. And, you know, I was learning how to parse out the different understandings and interpretations and learning how to exegete the scriptures. And I mean, it was awesome. And during that time, my mom started giving me tapes from this taped sermons from this church up north in Indiana, and she, you know, and it was interesting to me. I mean, as a kid, as a young guy like that and newly in the Lord, it was very fascinating. It's no wonder this guy had a big following, because he had a great way of presenting things, and it was a very, you know, very intellectually stimulating, very interesting stuff. And so at one point I thought, you know what, I'm gonna go up to that church. I'm going to go up there and live up there. And so that summer, I went down and airbrushed t-shirts at Surf Hut back in the days. It was 82. Surf Hut had the sand floor. I don't know if you people are from around here or not, but they had the sand floor, and I was airbrushing there. In fact, Chris Timms was just down the street at Surf Shack that year. And I'd go down there and pore over Chris's notebooks, man. He's an awesome artist. But anyway, and so we were working down there. I started learning how to surf, and I was just really getting into beach culture, but I left all that and I went up to Indiana. I determined, you know, this was my purpose. I saved up money. I went up to Indiana because I was going to go to this church. And I got up to this church, and man, it's like 2,000 people, and there's young people everywhere. And it was the dynamic of that place was just amazing to me. And I, you know, all of a sudden I thought, hey, you know, maybe I'll find a wife up here. There's all these women. You know, you're a young guy, that's the way you think. And so, you know, I was looking around at all of that, but I mean, I was just really desiring, I was selling out on every level of wanting to get involved in this church and all of their doctrines and what they saw. And one day I was standing down there on the front row, because, you know, really spiritual people are on the front, and that's not true. But, well, I'm sure it's true for you. I didn't mean it like that. Poor you, I'm sorry. What I'm saying is, forget what I'm saying. That was just stupid, and I'm so sorry. But anyway, I'm down in the front row, and I'm supposed to be worshiping the Lord. But I look over to my left, and here's this girl. She's got like brownish blonde hair, and I looked over at her, and I'm just like, wow, she's cute. And I'm telling you, the thought popped into my head. There's your wife, and I thought, you know, I thought you. Pervert, you. What are you doing? You're supposed to be worshiping the Lord, and you're scoping the babes, and you're going to hell. And so I was rebuking myself for all of that, and I put that out in my head. But we eventually did meet. She can tell you about how we met real quick.
Well, one day at church, someone came up to me and said, hey, there's this new guy that's coming to church now, and I think he just moved up from Florida, and he's a surfer. And, well, I got really interested in that idea, and so I was also wondering if he was the same person who was parking next to me at church. And I had brought my Volkswagen Bug from Southern California, and I saw this other Bug parked next to mine with Florida plates. and some really cool artwork on the dashboard, which I later came to find out was airbrush. I'd never heard of that before, never seen that done, but I just thought it was really cool. So anyway, that person I was talking to said, well, look, there he is right now. She said to me, well, have you guys met? And I said, no, we haven't. And she looked at me and she said, well, okay, Robbie, meet Robbie. And right away I got so embarrassed and my heart just sunk. I thought, oh great, we have the same name, that's so embarrassing. He started to walk away, but I was trying to continue the conversation and I said, hey, so what do you think of Indiana? But he never turned around or acknowledged me. I don't know if he didn't hear me or if he just wasn't interested or what, but again, I was totally embarrassed. So anyway, that's how we met.
Yeah, so it turns out we did start hanging out together a little bit. Singles would get together and we'd go to Pizza Hut and do stuff like that. But I'm telling you, we did not get along at all. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was a California-Florida thing, but we just had some kind of competition stuff going on between us. And most of our conversation was just firing insults at each other, and to where either one of us would get mad by the time it was all over. It was like, I don't want anything to do with this person. Now, listen, honestly, I liked her. I mean, she was cute. She is cute. And I felt like I kept thinking about that thought that had popped into my head, and I just didn't know. I just thought, you know, is this supposed to be my wife or what? And finally, I just said, you know what? I'm putting this before the Lord. I'm not going to sit here and try to chase this girl or work things out, you know, according to my will. I want God's will on this. And I just surrendered it to him. And I, you know, prayed about it, and I just put it in his hands, and I walked away from the situation. I said, Lord, if this is really you, if this is what your will is for my life, you're going to work this out. You're going to take care of this. And so I just let it go. And some things kind of changed in her heart. Well, actually, she can tell you that part too.
Actually, we didn't always get along real well. We tended to fight quite a bit. And I really, at least for a while, just was not interested. But I had a girlfriend, and she was older than I was and a lot more mature. And she said to me one day, she goes, I don't know, there's something special about Rob. And that really intrigued me, and I thought, what is she seeing that I'm not seeing? I just didn't know. And so we went out of town for the weekend to Milwaukee, and as I was gone, I was thinking a lot about what she was saying, and I really started to miss him. So I thought, well, I'll just send him a postcard. That'll just be a nice way to, you know, be friendly again. And so I did, and when I got back to Indiana, we kind of struck up a friendship again, and actually shortly after that started dating. So that was basically how it all began.
So we started dating, and it was cool. I mean, you know, and after a while, I mean, I just knew I want to spend my life with this woman. I mean, I just knew there was no turning back in my mind. And so I asked her to marry me, and 6 months later, we got married. We eloped. We went over to Ohio again and got married there. That's back before we had kids. That's when we were cool. And I tell my kids all the time, I used to be cool till we had kids. But anyway, we got married, and then 9 months later, little Jessica was born, and then 14 and a half months later, Daniel was born, and 15 months after that, Bradley was born, and 18 months after that, Janelle was born, and then it dawned on us what was causing this. So we kind of got that under control, But we spent 10 years at that church, and basically our whole Christian worldview, our whole Christian identity was developed out of the teachings of that church. And it was, look at us, man, that's kind of frightening. It was a very legalistic environment. You'll never find pictures of Robbie in those days. She's not wearing a dress, and we didn't have a TV, we didn't have a radio. Well, we had a radio, but we didn't have a TV. We didn't know anything about outside culture or anything like that. We just cut ourselves off from it altogether. We were going to be holy, and that's the teachings and the dictates of that church. It was a strange mix of charismatic teachings and holiness teachings, and our whole identity was built around that. And you know, my whole life I'd been spending trying to find acceptance from my peers by performing well. And that's all I'd ever known, that if I perform well, if I do well, if I please everybody, then people will like me and I'll be accepted. And unfortunately, what happened through the legalistic teachings of this church, that kind of concept got reinforced again. But this time I took that same attitude and I applied it to my Father in heaven. And I started assuming that if I perform well, if I do well as a Christian, my Father will like me. But if I don't do well, if I fall short, well, he won't like me and I'll be on the outs with him. And so that's a hard life to live that way too. It's hard to live it that way among peers and friends. It's hard to live it in a religious environment like that. I'm telling you, it's hard. It's heavy on your bones. And after a while, it'll exhaust you. And after 10 years, we were to that place of exhaustion. And this church that we were part of had kind of opened up a little bit and started interacting with some other charismatic groups who saw things a little bit differently. And boy, that was something to me. All of a sudden, I was interacting with Christians who didn't interpret things exactly the way I had known to interpret them. And it was interesting to me. It was intriguing to me. And I was really into that. And of course, the leadership got in there right away and shut that all down and said, now that I think about it, that's all wrong. You can't do that. It's going to taint the pure word that we have and stuff. But for me, the doors had been opened. All of a sudden, a portal had opened up and I saw through it and saw a different world. And I began questioning everything about this group that I'd been involved in. And the minute I started questioning, which is why they never tell you to question, which is why I always tell you question everything. But anyway, so I went up to the leadership and I said, this doesn't seem right. I don't think I can go along with this. I don't think it's right for the way we're doing certain things. And the leader there rebuked me and tried to lay this guilt all over my shoulders. And I'm telling you, when I left that place that day, I knew that I was never going to go back there again. I knew that that was it. I'd cut my ties to that. And so now all of a sudden, Robbie and I, we're just these young kids in our own right. And we're trying to raise these four other kids. We're all trying to grow up together. And suddenly we find ourselves cut off from the church as we had known it. And we were wandering from church to church, just looking for a place where we could fit in. And it is not an easy task. You go from a closed environment like that, where everything is dictated to you, and you're told exactly what to believe, to suddenly, this wide open venue of all these different churches. And it was a difficult time. And it was a real transition, a real serious transition that took place in our life. And I've talked for so long, I don't normally keep you here this long, but I'm going to stop the story there because the next part of the story directly affects everybody else here. And so I want you to be a part of it, and I want you to be able to see it, and we're going to know more about how Eastgate itself got started, and we'll get to the philosophies of what it is that the Lord's put together here. Is that cool? I mean, I hope I didn't bore you guys today, but I appreciate it all. Please don't do that. Don't do that. But if Riley and the band want to come on up, and we'll just close with a song here. You can stand with us if you will. I don't do altar calls or things like that, but just by any chance, if you're sitting here this morning and any of that has rung true with you, if you're sitting here and you don't have a relationship with Jesus and you're not exactly sure what it is that you've been longing for or looking for, I can assure you this, that what you've been looking for and longing for is Jesus. And it doesn't require walking down an aisle. It doesn't require anything like that. What it requires is, in your heart, just that simple prayer like my dad prayed, even like I prayed. I don't understand this, but I'm going to give my life to you. I'm going to cast my lot in with you. And I'm trusting you to lead me from there. If you do that in your heart, if you'll surrender your life to him, it'll make all the difference in the world. From that point on, you're going to know an acceptance that doesn't fall short like this world's acceptance falls short, that doesn't fail, that doesn't falter, that remains the same and is always true. And I encourage you to do that if you don't know him. I encourage you to turn your heart to him.